I was reading the paper the other day, and they had an article on a young lady that had some type of disease with a little girl, I think around 4 years old. And as a result of the disease, they had to amputate one of her legs to keep her from whatever it was spreading and killing her. So by amputating one of her legs, she was able to live. They showed her in an Arkansas Razorback cheerleading outfit. And she was, I believe, the head cheerleader, whatever. But she had made it to that level with one leg that was not normal. Now, this leg was not just any leg like you see a lot of the veterans wearing, the little thing at the bottom and it's springy. It was different colors. I think it's kind of like a zebra or something. And I think to me it was kind of attractive. Well, a lot of people have handicaps. There's a plethora of handicaps that we are either born with or we develop as we go along. For example, there's lots of young children that are born with drug-induced handicaps. Physically, when they're born and their mother's been on crack or heroin or cocaine or whatever, they have to go through this very hard physical point in their life where they have to get them off of that drug. They've been used to it while they were a fetus in their mother's womb. And it's a sad, very sad situation, but it just shows you that very handicapping. I knew a man once that was a great carpet layer, but he had this drinking handicap, and so he'd end up losing most of his job because he'd get into these, what do you call them, binges and not show up for work and so on and so forth. That was a handicap for him. In sports, there's a handicap. Now, what is a handicap? I mean, if you've got a 7 handicap, don't you have to give the other people playing with you 7? I think that's the way it works, actually. The handicap for the person that's not as good is an asset to him. But for the guy who's mastered the game to a greater degree, it's not a benefit for him. So it's a point where you try to get matched evenly, whether you have good talent or bad. There's many handicaps in sports. This girl I was talking about, this cheerleader, that leg that she had was very attracting. People noticed it because it was not like the regular, artificial legs. It was very colorful. Now, I know that she was not wearing that colorful leg to draw attention to her, but it was drawing attention to what she had accomplished, even though she had this handicap. I have seen on television where, I guess it was either an accident and the man could not use his arms, or he didn't have arms. I've seen both of these. And the guy had become a tremendous painter. He would put the brush in his mouth and he could paint beautifully. I've seen men without hands and arms, and they learned how to use their feet. They could feed themselves with their feet. They could use a remote or whatever it is that you do with your hands. They had adapted to that handicap, and guess what? It's much less of a handicap for them when they develop these skills. In these situations, a handicap is an opportunity to just see how far you can go, even though you do have a handicap. I had a handicap when I was growing up, and it was called self-consciousness, and I was terribly shy, extremely shy. I couldn't even go up and make friends. I'd let my brother make them for me. He would introduce them to me after he had made friends with them. I was extremely conscious. I would not go out and swim in a swimsuit because I was tall, skinny, and had legs like a crane or a stork. And I was self-conscious, and it handicapped me. There was a lot of activities that I would have liked to have been involved in, but with this handicap I had in my mind, I wouldn't. I couldn't make myself do it because I knew I just looked terrible. That's a handicap. How many of you have been in school or on a playground somewhere and you had these that were there that would pick people to be on their team? Anybody get involved in that in school where they would pick the ones they wanted on their team, on their side? Was anybody the last person? you know how it makes you feel. You're there with your peers, and nobody wants you. And it begins to create a mental handicap. Somehow you think you're defective. You're not productive. You're not good enough to be on the team, and nobody wants you. Been there and done that. Now, the thing that is funny to me now is that when they were picking for a basketball team, they would pick me. I was over 6 feet tall, and they assumed that I could be a good basketball player. Now, this white boy couldn't jump. I had no jump, and I could not dribble the ball. I'd want to go this way, and the ball would go off that way. Now, I could maybe stand up there and keep somebody from scoring if they were a lot shorter than me, but that's about it for me. Looks were deceiving. They thought, oh, he's going to be a good basketball player. Or he's going to be a good volleyball player. Nah, far from the truth. I wasn't good at any of those jumping sports. Now, I was really, in my opinion, good at baseball until I got into upper classes, and the guys were catching up to me in height. They were catching up and actually passing me in their ability to play baseball. So when I was standing there and I was waiting to be picked, and my twin brother was there, and I was picked for this one team, and I heard somebody say something about my brother probably would be a better player. And I said, well, actually, I'm a better player. That was the wrong thing to say. And so he was excited. So, he was telling the rest of the team members, he's better than his brother. Well, when it come up time to hit the ball, I barely got it through the infield. So it was one of those situations where I was brought down to a level that I should have been. I shouldn't have been so vain, cocky, or whatever. So people find all sorts of reasons to be handicapped. I remember a sermon years and years ago that Mr. Ron Dart gave, and many of you may remember the name, the title, and if you do, you probably remember a big part of the sermon. It was called A Wooden Leg. Anybody remember that sermon, Mr. Ron Dart? A Wooden Leg. And he went through these issues people have that would cause them to be less productive, less self-esteem. And so this one today I've entitled Handicaps. There's probably not any of us that have never gone through our lives without some sort of handicap, something that wants to cause us to suppress ourselves and not develop our abilities. As we go through this, we're going to see that no matter how tall, no matter how large, no matter how fast, there's always somebody better. And that somebody better may be on your team, and they may be this tall. On the basketball team, who's the guy that kind of directs the flow of the game for his team? It's a point guard. He comes down, he sets up the play. He passes it off to somebody, and then whatever, they just go through these routines. I'm not a basketball player, but I have seen that. I like to watch the Lakers when they play. And there's a team for you. You've heard the saying, best team money can buy? Well, their team costs a lot, but they're under 500% this year. Why is that? Because they're not a good match. They don't play together. They compete with each other. Kobe's number one, but they got this big guy named Howard. He's a center, or at least a tall forward, but I think he's a center. And not a center, but a center. Oh, yeah, he's a center too. But aren't we all? But anyway, they've got him. I personally thought that would make the team much better. But they're like 15 and 20 or something like that. I mean, they're way down below a lot of the other teams in their district. You can take that small point guard, and he can come up against a tall center. I keep sounding like it's center. He can overcome the the worst center, a center, by his quickness. He can go around real quick and just lay up the basket. So who's most important? They're both important. It's a team. And when team members don't flow with each other and they don't look for somebody else, they're not selfish, but they're selfless, and they get to a point where maybe somebody's going to screen them or whatever, they toss it to a person who's open, who has the ability to put the shot through the bucket. Teamwork. It overcomes handicaps. Now, the point guard couldn't go and play center. center. My pronunciation is not very good. He couldn't play center. But he's not the least important member on the team. If he's like the center they have now for L.A., his name is Steve Nash. I believe he's probably got more assists than any basketball player that ever played. By assist, I mean he's got the ball and he flips it to somebody else and they make the score. He gets an assist. Been a selfless player, not a selfish player. And wherever he's been up until this time right now in L.A., he's been very successful. And again, I don't know what the problem is with those people, but they're except the fact that they're not playing as a team. Somebody blind, whether they were born blind or it happened by accident, you know the other senses they have are enhanced because they no longer can see and use the eyes anymore. So their hearing and their taste, their smell, those sort of things are enhanced. And they can, a lot of them can just hear music played on a piano or a guitar or whatever and pick it up by ear. They can't see the person chord. They can't see which keys they hit, but they learn those by ear. And they can actually produce beautiful music. They can tell how a person looks by putting their hands and fingers on their face. They can see something beautiful by it being described by somebody else who has sight. And they can see it, so to speak, in their mind's eye. And it takes the handicap away. Again, handicaps should be an opportunity for success. Different type of success, possibly, but success nonetheless. You remember when God called Moses to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. When God spoke to Moses and said, I'm going to use you, he said, to speak to the people, Moses said, wait a minute, I am slow of speech. And felt like he had a handicap. So God used his brother Aaron to convey what Moses was saying. God spoke to Moses, and Moses gave it to Aaron. He gave it to the children of Israel. There's always a solution. Then you have Jeremiah. And you like to turn to the book of Jeremiah, the first chapter. Let's pick up something here. He also had a handicap in his mind. When God called him, he said, verse 6, chapter 1 of Jeremiah, then said I, Lord God, behold, I cannot speak, for I'm a child. I'm not mature enough. I'm not old enough. I'm not learned enough. Then God goes ahead and points out in verse 9, then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth. And the Lord said unto me, behold, I have put my words in your mouth. A young man. Maybe a teenager, maybe a very young adult. But he told God, I can't do it. I'm just too young. I don't have the equipment, the knowledge. None of us do. Until God touches us into your mind, you don't have it either. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll touch and anoint your body, your lips, where you can speak what I want you to tell your people. The handicap was over. The excuses were over. And Jeremiah went back to doing what God told him. Verse 10 says, see, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out, to pull down, to destroy and to throw down, to build and to plant. Young man. Very young man. I've told you before that I watched that show, Alaskan Gold Rush. And one of the people that has a mind, he's doing it for his grandfather. His grandfather's like high 80s, low 90s. I mean, he's an old man. And this kid is like 17, 16. But he has the maturity of an adult. I can't get over how mature he is for his age. How he uses his mind to determine what needs to be done next. I mean, he's organized. He knows how to go about looking for the gold. I mean, it makes me feel like he probably grew up there with his grandfather in the minefields looking for gold because he's so mature. So this handicap was taken care of, and ours can too. Whether they're real or imagined, our handicaps can be taken away from us. Now, some people are handicapped by their beliefs. Let's go to Mark, the 7th chapter. A belief is a paradigm being a pattern, an example, an overall concept accepted by most people. That's a paradigm. A concept that is accepted by most people. How can you use that in your mind to tell you about today's religion? Well, you can say the concept is that Jesus Christ was born on December 25th, and they exchanged gifts. No, they just brought gifts. They've put in all of these accoutrements of pagan religion into that. Another tradition that people have is keeping Easter. And what that does is skew the view of the Passover. Even when they read about it in 1 Corinthians, let us keep the feast, meaning the Passover, the days of unleavened bread. But they are handicapped because they have been raised to believe that these things are so. So it puts them at a disadvantage to you and I. But again, we can't take credit for it because it's God who develops the mind in us, the mind of Christ in each and every one of us to some degree or another. So in the book of Mark, in the 7th chapter, begin verse 1, then came together to him the Pharisees and certain of the scribes which came from Jerusalem. And then when they saw some disciples eat bread with that were defiled, that is to say, they weren't washed, they found fault. They were always looking for some sort of, I gotcha, with Christ or the disciples, whatever. I gotcha. They were looking for that I gotcha moment. I caught you. And so he says, the Pharisees, verse 3, and all the Jews, except they wash their hands often, do not eat, holding the traditions of the forefathers, the elders. Now, this church that they had a huge hand in developing had put the traditions at the same level as the gospel. Does that sound familiar? Can you tell me what church is very large that says they're Christ's disciples? It's a huge church, probably 1 billion, who have all of these traditions. You know, they have all of these traditions. And what does it do? It masks, it deflects, it skews the truth. And when you grow up, what are you going to learn? You're going to learn about their traditions because they hold their traditions as high as the good news. So a child growing up in that church or another church, Protestant church, they're handicapped. It's like I said a few weeks back, they come under the spell of this toxic society. And so it's very difficult and sometimes impossible if they don't throw away these practices, these traditions, to implant in them a seed that will germinate. Makes sense, doesn't it? You put a good seed in tainted soil, and it's not going to grow. I've mentioned to you before, I'll do it again because it illustrates what I'm saying. The people we bought our house from dug a well in the house. The one that was there before they put the new one in was close to the septic tank. Hello? And their two boys kept being sick and had to go to the hospital time and time again. And finally it dawned on somebody, I don't know who it was, but somebody in that family had dawned on them that, well, our water might be tainted. So they had it checked, and sure enough, it had sewage in it. Raw sewage. Like, duh. So when they dug this new well, it's a 36-inch well. Came out of it, they put over to the sides of the well. Now, that was over 33 years ago, probably about 35 years ago. Do you know that there's nothing growing there now? Still, nothing growing there now. Now, my thoughts are that soil is too acidic. And it goes to these traditions, soils what should be fertile, loamy soil in a human's mind, it just makes it toxic, very hard to reach. Because when you grow up learning all these things all your life, it's much harder to discard them and unlearn what you've been brought up with. I was caught up in that with my mother growing up up until the time God called me. I know what it is. So these are handicaps, and it actually makes somebody very hard to progress to the point that God wants them to. They have this handicap, and it's always on their shoulder. And whenever they might learn something new from God, the traditions come to swallow it up. So here we see that they're always looking for somebody to blame, the Pharisees and scribes. Verse 4 says, "And when they come from the market, except they wash, they do not eat. And many other things there be which they have received to hold, as a washing of cups and pots, brazen vessels of tablets. And many other things there be which they have received to hold, as traditions that are equal to the Word of God." They hold these traditions very, very closely, and they try to keep them extant in the church. In verse 6, Christ answered and said that Isaiah had spoke well, because he says, "He prophesied of you hypocrites, and as it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." That's a handicap. I don't care how many times you take God's name, how much you put on your stationery, quotes from the Bible, how many bumper stickers you put on there, how many churches with steeples you walk into, how many times you go to church, every time the doors open, so what? And so he's talking to them here and saying, "My Father's name, and you may talk about a Messiah to come, you're looking at him. But by your traditions, you deflect the truth, preach lies and traditions." Says verse 7, "Howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." The Catholic Church, and I'm not just picking on the Catholic Church, but they are so easy to pick on. They're the ones that decided to change the Sabbath. And they made it impossible to live in a community if you tried to keep the Sabbath. You were a closet Sabbath keeper because they threatened you. If they caught you Judaizing, as they said, on the seventh day, you were in trouble. And I don't know how many saints and martyrs, actual real saints and real martyrs, have been killed by the Catholic Church doing God a service. Now, they're handicapped to the point that your life, if they believe you're a heretic or whatever, back in the day, the church would have you killed. I don't get it. I don't understand. But they're taught to believe that they must annihilate the heretics, or they were. They don't do it anymore. And now we've got the Muslims and their fanatical part of religion that say the same thing. "We need to get rid of all these infidels." And they're brought up to believe that. And they get young kids and brainwash them and have them go with some sort of explosive and walk into a crowd and just, I guess when they get old enough, that they'll have, how many virgins is it they say?
70.
Well, I suppose that could be incentive if you're Muslim. But there's nothing in the Bible about 70 virgins when you get to heaven. It's a tradition. It's man speaking. And he also says, verse 8, "For laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men, as the washing of pots and cups, and many other such like things you do. Full well you reject the commandment of God, that you may keep your own traditions." 70 virgins. I'm still thinking about that. I mean, it's what they believe and what they tell. See, I want to move on now to Colossians, the second chapter. Again, speaking about the mental and spiritual defects that it causes, actually do cause a healthy person to become handicapped. Colossians, the second chapter, he has a lot to say here. In verse 18, it talks about mystical teaching. He says, "Let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary and humility and worshiping of angels, intruding into those things that he has not seen." I don't know. I might have met an angel in my lifetime, but if I did, I couldn't recognize him. And I may have. But they were teaching the worshiping of angels, which in the scriptures is nowhere found. "And he has not seen these things, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind." A carnal person teaching the worshiping of angels. "And not holding the head, from which all the body by joints and bands, having nourishment, ministered." All of the people in the church, all of the joints and bands and parts of the body of Christ are extremely important, and none have handicaps. When it comes to what God wants you to know spiritually, you have no handicap, because he will make sure you understand. And I've learned recently that there's a lot of voluntary humiliation that I was involved in over the years. I won't get too far into them, but one of them was that, oh, well, you don't have a television on, you don't watch television, you don't listen to the radio. If you don't believe you should, you better not. But I no longer believe that I can't. Now, maybe some of the programming I'm choosing might be offensive to my Creator, but just the fact of turning it on and maybe watching the Gold Rush or something like that, or National Geographic, I no longer find fault with it. I'm not trying to cleanse myself, because only God can do that. Until He convinces me of something, then I'm not going to be convinced. I might, my own will, self-will and self-righteousness, I might abstain from something. But He says here, they're not holding up the head from which all the body, joints, and bands, having nourishment ministered and knit together, increases with the increase of God. The church, the bands, the links, the parts of the body are increased, knit together, increases with the increase of God. I want to drop down now to verse 20. Wherefore, if you be dead with Christ from the rudiments of the world, the traditions, the paradigms of churchianity, if you will, if you're dead to all of those things that you were a part of before, the rudiments and traditions of the world, he says here, why, as though living in the world, are you subject to ordinances, worshiping angels, practicing lasciviousness? Because there was a law extant in the minds of men that the more you sin, go grab 70 virgins. Because the more you sin, the more you are forgiven. So let us just go out and sin and get a lot of forgiveness. And Paul says, God forbid, God forbid. But they were teaching these things. It says, continually it says here, why, as though living in the world, you are subject to ordinances, touch not, taste not, handle not, which are all to perish with the using after the commandments and doctrines of men. Which things have indeed a show of wisdom in will worship and humility. I mean, you can actually will worship not to do something. You can actually humble yourself not to eat or drink. Now, I'm not saying fasting for the right reasons. I'm talking about just, well, you know, I'll be a better person if I just do this. I'll abstain from this. Or if it's not in the Bible, pork and things like that, yes, abstain from. But the other things, I don't find it. But it says it does have indeed a show of wisdom and will worship and humility and neglecting of the body, not in any honor to the satisfying of the flesh. The fleshly lusts are still going to be there. We've been in the world long enough that there are certain things that we want to eat or drink or you know, indulge in, and maybe overly indulge. We could force ourselves not to. It's not going to clear your conscience of this thing that's bothering you. Only God can lead you away from that with prayer, and you might use fasting. But they were practicing asceticism, and they were... My margin says here, Christ had freed them from the taboos of asceticism, which can only give a pretense of wisdom, promote a self-made religion, and deal severely with the body, yet it cannot succeed in combating the desires of the flesh. Only the Spirit of God can do that. I could fast for the next 6 weeks and only drink water unless God moves me and purges me of something. I'm not going to do it myself by fasting. It's just not going to happen. If I fast for the right reasons, then it can happen. But these people were thinking they were being real righteous, which in reality they were being righteous overmuch, and they were practicing verity to the bottom, asceticism, denying lots of things, putting their bodies through things that were harmful and for no reason other than just a show. In 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, I love this chapter. It spells out and it helps us to understand how the Spirit works in each and every one of you. Because the Spirit enters you, it works with you, it enhances you, it attributes to you certain gifts maybe that you didn't have before. It helped me to be able to come up before you and speak. Something that I never could have done on my own. Never. I know that. I know God made it happen. I know God made it possible. I didn't do it. I couldn't do it. I wanted to be outgoing. I wanted to be friendly. I wanted to go to dances and, you know, dance with girls. I wanted to date. But I was just too self-conscious and shy. I think maybe in high school I had maybe a couple of dates, and they were uncomfortable for me and probably for the person that was with me. I really believe that. I really do. And it's because I was self-conscious and I was scared of girls. Whatever that means. I was like the, I see movies now where young boys in the movie will try to go up and talk to a girl, and maybe they feel handicapped that they're not up to this level where... I saw one the other day, it was real cute. This freshman had spotted a senior girl, and oh, he was just smitten at first sight. And everybody was telling him, she's above you, or what do they call it? She's out of your league. Well, the guys telling him that was trying to handicap him. You know what it did? It just made him more determined. But the first time they had an encounter talking... It sounded like something I would say. This girl that he liked was with another young lady there on the school grounds. The one he liked had a dress on, and the only thing you could say is, that's a pretty dress. And if I remember right, he went into the bathroom, and then he started beating on his head. It's a pretty dress? She kind of grinned and chuckled a little bit, and they went about their own ways. But I can relate to that because that's the way I was. I mean, you stumble over your words and you just feel like you're inadequate and you can't do those things. And then I met Clara, and those things changed. But here in this chapter, it's talking about the things that the Spirit of God gives you, and it tells about the purpose of gifts and unity and diversity. You know, I told you that a team consists of different sizes and shapes and abilities and proclivities. But when they're all molded together, one supports the other. If you start a home, you want it started on a good foundation. Otherwise, it's a brick home. It's going to crack the brick along the walls outside. I've seen it many times. And if you have a frame home and it's not on a good foundation, then you're going to... The doors are not going to want to open and shut because of the shifting of the house. Like ours, the drainage was terrible from the back of the house all the way under the house to the outside. Until I did some landscaping or drainage work. And it caused the kitchen to settle. And you could see it. And over here at this end of the kitchen, which was the south end, going to the north, you're walking downhill. So much that you would really notice it you could by just walking, but you could see it. You could see where it was based on a terrible design and foundation. So I had to have somebody come up and lift up that floor, the foundation. Our foundation is Christ. And everything that we are able to build upon is something that has been gifted to us and provided for us. In verse 12, chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians, verse 12. For as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. And that's why Paul found it so disturbing to him when he saw the schisms in the church, the Corinthian church. There were these personality cults going on, and he found it very disturbing because he says, the body of Christ should not be attracted to one person over another. The love should permeate to everyone. You might be fonder of somebody for some reason or closer to them. Maybe they have something, you have something in common. But the love that you have should be as much for that person as this person, if it's possible, because sometimes people won't allow you to get close to them. I don't want to embarrass Don, but it's evident to all of us that, and we're all so proud for Don, that, and I don't know what caused it with Don, but he had a handicap. He was not real outgoing. He would, to come up here and sing a song, none of us would have believed that Don was going to do that. None of us. But he not only did it, but he did it in front of 200 plus people at the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, you had to overcome a lot to be able to do that, Don. I know in my heart of hearts that that wasn't easy, but he did it. Handicap, it's nothing. When God moves you through his Spirit, He enables you to do things that you could never do before. All you have to do is yield to that Spirit. If you're feeling like you're being kind of led in a certain direction, go for it. Don't set up some sort of a handicap that would keep you from fulfilling the purpose God has for you. That's what he's talking about these members. He said, verse 13, "For by one Spirit are we all baptized into one body, whether we be Jews or Gentiles." You know, they were separated before. Jews were a certain place in the area of the synagogue and or the temple, and the Gentiles were separated from them. "Whether you're free or bond, you've all been made to drink into one Spirit. For the body is not one member, but many. If the foot shall say, 'I am not the hand, I am not of the body,' is it therefore not of the body?" If the foot has a handicap and says, "I'm not a part of the body because the foot is the lowest part of the human." Can be the stinkiest part too. But here he's saying this is, you could say, just person believes that they're not as important as somebody else in the church. And it couldn't be further from the truth. "And the ear shall say, 'Because I am not the eye, I am not of the body.' Is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If everybody wanted to be the center, where would be your point guard? Where would be your shooting guards? Where would be your forward?" I'm telling you, you can't have a basketball team with all guards or all centers, or it doesn't work. Because you can't overcome height by your speed and agility and the ability to shoot. Verse 17, "If the whole body were an eye, where's the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where's the smelling? But now God has set the members, every one of them, in the body as it has pleased him." If you don't go away from here learning anything else, learn this. You were handpicked by God the Father. The person, the entity that said, "Let us make man in our own image," handpicked each and every one of you. I can't hardly fathom that. I know it is, but I just can't hardly fathom it. Why would he handpick this motley crew? Because you probably feel like I do. Why did he pick me? What did he see in me that might? Why did he pick Paul? In essence, in reality, really, Paul was a murderer. And he put people in prison. And he was trying to put down all of these heretics who called themselves disciples of Christ. God gave him a handicap. And Paul said, "In my handicap, in my weaknesses, I am strong." He says, "I glory in my infirmities. I glory in my weaknesses because they have enhanced the better things that God has given me." Sometimes we feel handicapped because we're standing next to somebody that is more intellectually gifted. Somebody could be, like I always felt when I was standing next to a big football player, muscular guy, or if I was standing next to the head cheerleader and she was blonde and blue eyes and beautiful. I had a weaknesses back in my high school days, blonde hair, blue eyes. But I felt inadequate and inferior. It was something that it was just in me. I couldn't deal with it. Didn't know how to deal with it. But here he says, each and every one of us has been picked by him as it pleases him. So all other handicaps that we feel like we have, just throw them out. Throw them out on the ground. Throw them out of the door. If your eye offends you, pluck it out. Not literally, but if you have a weakness for looking at women or men, women have a weakness looking at men longer than they should, just turn your head. Pluck your eye out. Turn your head. Put the thoughts out of your mind if you're having thoughts. I mean, these sorts of things that God equips us to do. We could overcome any handicaps that we've had before because he handpicked us. He's giving us the ability to do things that we couldn't do before. Verse 22. "Nay, much more, those members of the body which seem to be more feeble are necessary. And those members of the body which we think to be less honorable, upon those or these we bestow more abundant honor, and our uncomely parts have more abundant comeliness. For our comely parts have no need, but God has tempered the body together. He has combined the body. He has taken a mediocre point guard and put him with others that are very talented. And as long as that point guard can just get the ball to somebody that can shoot, be very successful. You don't have to be the best player. It's all about teamwork. It's all about using and utilizing every gift on the team. We are a team. We are a force. And every team member has importance. I don't know if you noticed or not, but just before I came up here to speak, a lovely lady brought me a glass of water. And it made me think about the reward of God. That somebody that brings you a cup to drink in my name, they will not lose their reward. God will see to it. They are honored in His kingdom. So I appreciate that. I know God does. In John, the 6th chapter, let's go there. I'll close with John. I've got several more notes, but John, the 6th chapter, I want to reaffirm in our minds what God has done for us. Without our knowledge, it was going to happen. And God, it's interesting that when Jeremiah said, I'm too young, he says, Jeremiah, I knew you from your mother's womb. He knew of that egg in that womb that was going to be somebody that he was going to use before Jeremiah was born. He chose him in his mother's womb. Was he going to stick him out there amongst the people and give him the words to say just to have him scorned and ridiculed and killed? He knew Jeremiah. He knew that egg that would become Jeremiah with the seed of man. And I dare say, Jeremiah had no conscience of it before God told him to go and speak. None whatsoever. I had no conscience that I would be serving God in the capacity that I do today. I'll just cut to verse 44. No man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day. It is written in the prophets, and they shall be all taught of God. Every man, therefore, that has heard and has learned of the Father comes to me. So our calling is of God. Our being is of God. Our proclivities, our gifts, our abilities are of God. And God doesn't give us any handicaps. God's Son was a perfect offering with no handicaps. And He's given that spirit of His and the Son's to us. We have a tremendous calling and a tremendous opportunity. And I'll tell you this one other thing that I remembered in the Bible this morning. You remember the story where there was a blind man and some of the people around Christ said, who sinned, him or his parents? Now that's a tremendous handicap to be blind. And they just assumed that he did something wrong or his parents did. So they asked, this happened to him so that the power and glory of God could be evident to the people at that time. And God has given us assets, and it's our duty to find them and use them as best we can.